Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Julie Zygfuss, artist, writer, natural historian, and we're talking about her new book, Saving Jemima, Life and Love with a Hard Luck J. Julie, welcome back to the show. It's been too long since we've talked.
I know. I love your interviews the most.
I love talking to you a lot. This Saving Jemima, this story is really, and the way that it's written, is quite unlike your other books that I've read. And I had a totally different feeling personally reading it. First of all, it's a focus on one bird, although there's other birds that sort of play into this. But an awful lot of your personal life and your inner life becomes part of this book. And I thought that was really a revelation.
Oh, well, that's wonderful to hear. It was both fun and scary and thrilling to write.
I was going to ask you if you felt like you were putting a lot of yourself out there.
Absolutely, and I can't tell you how many iterations there were of the chapter "Who's Saving Whom."
Yep. Oh yeah.
there was the bear. There was the tell all. There was the, you know, and then this is somewhere in between tell all and bare bones.
Oh my God! Yeah. And any author doing this, especially this level of stuff that's going on in your life, while the bird drama is going on, there's a lot of personal drama, and as there is in a lot of people's life. It's got to have been sort of this an amazing year for you to have lived through. I'm glad you're on this end of it.
Yeah, me too. Me too. It feels really good to be on the other side of it, I hope. I mean, I guess one of the consequences of having a year like I've had, in which my husband and my mother-in-law died within 2 months of each other, badly, both of them, and lots of other stuff happened in 2017, which is detailed in the book. But one of the consequences of that is that you find yourself just waiting for that boot to drop. You're always kind of thinking, oh, well, you know, that probably isn't it. They're probably not done with me. There's got to be something hanging over
right,
my head.
You never want to come out and say, this is as bad as it's going to get. So everything
no.
else, no, you never want to say that.
You
never
no, you want don't. To.
However, you also learned a lot of sort of great internal spiritual lessons about being happy with what you've got.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, how did Jemima come into your life? Now, you've been rehabbing for dog's years.
Yeah.
And, you know, you've written books about rehabbing birds. And how did Jemima specifically come into your life?
Well, I had decided to go Red October on bird rehab because I was so tired.
And I was trying to do a serious interview and you just blew that, okay?
No, I was really, really tired of answering the phone like 6 times a day.
Oh,
I found a baby bird on the other end, right?
Oh, God.
And, you know, that all becomes my problem. And the other thing that was happening is that I was getting fawn calls and bat calls and turtle calls. I get everything. And so I decided to let my wildlife rehab permit lapse.
Wow.
And, wow. Yeah, which is crazy since I've had one since like 1981 because I just couldn't do it anymore. I decided to get a scientific collecting permit, which would permit me to handle and paint baby birds and raise the occasional one, I thought, while, you know, it could actually permit me to do my work without listing my home phone number with every vet and wildlife officer in the state, in addition to online. That's what the state requires if you have a wildlife rehab permit.
I never knew that. And
yeah, you got to give them a good number. And
who would want to do that? That's
yeah. Who wants to do that? Right. And so yeah, it was a huge invasion of my privacy and my private life. So I got this scientific collecting permit, and I thought, great, I can still do my baby bird paintings. I can help birds that I find, you know, but I won't be opened up to a huge pipeline. Well, then what happened was, of course, Facebook, and 5,000 people have instant message access to me. And so there's talk about not being able to escape something. So, you know, it was all very fine when they were from New Zealand and they said, what do I do with this, you know, baby moa that I found? But it's, you know, it's like when they're from Marietta and they have a baby blue jay and then they send you a photo of it.
Oh, sucked in.
Yeah, sucked in, and it's clearly dying, and you're just like, okay, bring it to me. So that was how I got Jemima. And the gal who brought it to me is a friend, and, you know, there's just some things you have to do. And so within 10 seconds of holding that bird in my hand, I was completely smitten, and I knew I was going to raise my first corvid.
Now, I'm telling the audience and you in advance, I don't want to give away a lot towards the end of the book.
Right.
Because
on.
People need to read it.
Yeah.
But there's a lot in between. And I want to mention, for the benefit of the audience, there are great photographs, but as always, the part that I really like is your artwork. There's a lot of artwork, too.
Awesome.
I love your work, especially in this. Jemima really becomes a member of your household pretty quickly. And is it because it was a jay that she just sort of, like, took over?
Yeah, you know birds, and I know birds, and I knew the intelligence sparkling in the eyes of this little crow, basically this little blue crow I had in my hand. I knew that this was going to be a great ride. And so because I've learned that anything you pay close attention to can potentially be a book, I started writing the minute I got the bird. And I was really glad I did. I kept a daily log of what she did, and I photographed her breathing. I photographed and videotaped everything she did.
And there's some amazing paintings in this book. There's a whole series of the changes in her head feathering.
Oh, yeah, isn't that fun?
That's an amazing painting right then and there.
Well, you know, it's not something anybody would really want to hang on their wall, but
no, never say that. I would so hang that on my wall.
Yeah, you know, the bald jay going to the beautiful jay in 2 weeks.
It's how we all want to go. I want to be in that direction.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, you're a big old science chimp like me. So, you know, that's the kind of stuff that thrills me. And I've been putting together the talk for Saving Jemima, and I realized that I paint stuff that it does not occur to other people to paint.
Mm-hmm. That's why it's so cool.
And that's what makes it fun and cool for me, and cool for people who appreciate inquiry and curiosity to look at. And I don't care if nobody wants to hang a blobby baby starling in their gallery. I want to paint it. So that's the engine that drives me.
So there.
Yeah.
Now, I don't want to talk about Jemima's relationships with everybody, but I have to talk about Jemima's relationship with Chet Baker, your dog. Because the poor dog, now first of all, and this is another thing that went on during that year, this dog that you've loved for so many years is definitely winding down.
Oh, yeah.
And now he's got this Jay.
Yep.
How would you describe that relationship?
Well, he was tolerant of her.
Okay.
And Chet had been conditioned from the time he was a puppy to never harm a feather on any bird. He was hell on chipmunks. I would show him a baby bird in my hand, and he would look at it once and then turn his head away, kind of like Jack Benny, and, you know, with this long-suffering sigh, like, okay, I'm never going to look directly at this thing again because I might want to bite it. So it was the cutest thing. So Jemima took full advantage of that, and because she was a corvid, she settled on the being in our household who was the closest to a jay, let's just say. I mean, he's certainly not bird-like, but he's more bird-like, let's say, than a 6-foot human is. So it was just the sweetest thing. She followed him everywhere. She chittered at him. She begged. She fluttered her wings. And she just, took him on as her focus of desire. And it was just adorable to see them interact. But, you know, at times I had to just put her in the garage because she was just too much for him.
She was picking his ear hair out.
Oh yeah. She was doing everything. She was gentle ministrations that became insufferable.
Now, for people who don't understand rehabbing creatures and especially birds, it takes an extraordinary effort to get any one bird so that you can release it. And the goal is always to release it. Not to keep it as a pet. I mean, it's amazing. About how long would it take? And how old was she when she first came to you?
She was about 11 days old when I got her, and she wasn't releasable until she was 38 days old. So it's quite a commitment, and you are there all the time. You can't, you know, really go anywhere. You have to, or unless you have the bird with you.
Now, one of the things I love is that you're very critical of these people who are so paranoid about imprinting. the bird. Talk to me about that, because you have a lot to say about that in this book.
Yeah, I do. I've given it a lot of thought, and I'm kind of a rogue outlier as a wildlife rehabber, and I do things that many rehabbers just shudder at, including raising birds in my house, because my house is what I have. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't have a big fancy facility with sterile cages or anything like that. And if you have to feed something every 30 minutes, it's kind of inconvenient to have to go out to the garage and, you know, do that. It's much better to just have it on the kitchen table and feed it. And, you know, I don't do that so I can turn them into pets. I do that because I'm a busy person, and that's the way I do it. And, in fact, I'm careful not to coddle, touch, pet, all that stuff. But that said, they are living, you know, with us. And so there is a prevailing opinion among a lot of wildlife rehabbers that because it is a corvid, a blue jay is vulnerable to becoming imprinted on its captors or its, you know, its caretakers. And, okay, yeah, that can happen, but you really have to work at it.
You also make it clear you're not sort of giving the animal itself enough credit.
Exactly. And that's the thing that we humans do. Our hubris gets in our way. We trip over it. And we assume that we are so great and omnipowerful that this bird, of course, is going to fall in love with us and, of course, is going to consider us its only companion or mate, when actually all they need is decent access to the sound and sight of their own kind, and they go, oh, yeah, I'm a blue jay. Mm-hmm.
And it's especially true for jays. Jays really are flock birds. They really they really are social birds. And there's some great shots of Jemima as she's growing up at the window, looking at other jays coming to your feeder. And it's like, and there was a case where you had film of Jemima and you brought it to a bird fair, I think. And there was a jay there that reacted to the film of Jemima.
Oh, this beautiful, beautiful bird named Conrad, who lives at the Audubon House in Mill Grove, Pennsylvania. He's an incredible education bird and is beautifully handled by Carrie Barron, their education director. That bird is priceless. He was raised in a family and, you know, pretty heavily acclimated to humans. I wouldn't say imprinted because I don't think he attempts to mate with people. But he's so friendly that the fear is that he would land on just anybody were he released. And that could be terrible because a lot of people hate blue jays and wave their arms and flail when wild birds land on their heads, unlike me who goes, hello, you know, welcome to my head. Most people don't think that's great. So anyway, Conrad is an education bird who travels around with Carrie and teaches people how cool blue jays are, and it's a wonderful job for him. But, you know, I look at Conrad and I think, you know you're a blue jay, and you will always know that. So even though he was raised in a home, and we just set up a video. I wanted to see what would happen if I played a video of Jemima singing, and that bird was just stock still and absolutely rapt for the duration of the video. And that, you know, I've been doing a lot of observation, and I think what's going on with jays is that their primary self-identity is through the auditory channel. They hear those innate calls, which they make innately.
And they have an incredible vocabulary.
They do, and they have incredible ability to mimic. Mm-hmm. But they hear that, and it touches something so deep and ancient in them that we humans can't mess that up.
One of the things that happens to the jays at my feeder is they'll come in, and there'll be a crowd at the feeder, and they'll imitate a raptor.
Yeah.
And everybody dives off, and they have the feeders to themselves.
Oh, they're not dumb.
They're not dumb at all.
Yeah.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Julie Zicafous, artist, writer, natural historian, and we're talking about her new book. It's really fine. Saving Jemima, Life and Love with a Hard Luck Jay. Now, hard luck really describes... She has all sorts of problems. Let's talk about one of them. She comes down. Now, this is after you've released her into the wild. She's still periodically coming down to feeders. You notice that she's come down with Mycoplasma gallisepticum, which better known as house finch disease.
Right, which a lot of us have seen in birds at our feeders who show up with their eyes swollen shut and fluttering blind or sitting on the ground all puffed up with their eyes closed. And Yeah, actually, the stress of release can smoke out a lot of stuff. And I think what happened was Jemima came to me with mycoplasma. And it is possible that she contracted that through the eggshell membrane. She may have been hatched with it. And I am convinced that that is what forced her out of the nest, unable to compete with her nest mate. She was very weak when she came in. And I gave her, I believe I gave her Baytril when she came in, just because I thought, she's got an infection, you know. And she perked up, and she acted normal, and everything went fine. But then 5 days after release, she shows up with this enormously swollen eye, or the, you know, conjunctivitis, not the eye itself, but the membranes around the eye. So my heart just went to my feet, because I'd put so much love and work into this bird, and to have her turn up with this deadly, deadly disease that could blind her was one of the most upsetting things I could imagine. And so I set to work figuring out how to cure her.
And you did it with her still just coming to the feeder.
Right. Yeah. The thing was, the dilemma.
This is not you. You didn't take the bird back in.
No. The dilemma that I faced was: do I take her back in the house and the garage tent for the 3 weeks it will take to cure her, when she's just been released and is just finding her way in nature, or do I try to treat her on the wing? And I chose B as my only option, because she was tearing my house up and just pooping everywhere and was tormenting the dog. And bringing her into the house was out of the question, but keeping her sequestered in the garage for 3 weeks alone would have driven her mad.
Right.
Because she was so social. So I thought, well, here's what I'll do. I will make sure our bond is strong. Instead of trying to break the bond as I do when I normally release a bird, I'll try to strengthen it. So I fed her the most delectable things, like roast pork and filet.
I was reading, and you have photographs of this too. I was going like, man, I could do this for supper.
I know. A lot of people say, I want to be a bird in your care.
And it's attractively put out.
Exactly. Oh, very nicely laid out. Presentation is important. So anyway, I just fed her the best stuff. And I sweetened her medicated water with stevia so that I wouldn't mess up her liver. But it tasted good to her. So, you know, Jays can take a lot more bitter taste than we can. And it was terribly bitter to me. So I sweetened it until you could taste the stevia over the bitter.
Wait a minute. And right there, and this, I came to this point in the book, too. Does that mean you tasted the medicine?
Oh, gosh, yes. I wanted to know what I was giving her. I mean, I started eating Gainsburgers as a little child. They were good for my dog.
She goes that far.
Yeah, so I worked out this thing where, she liked the medicated water, and she loved the food, and so I sprinkled tetracycline, which was tasteless, on her food, just as another sort of defense against this awful disease. But Thailand is the drug, Thylacin tartrate is the drug that actually can cure mycoplasma.
So much, the great thing about your books is there's so much of the personal in it, but there's also really important scientific information that you find out as you go along, because you're being the science, self-admitted science chimp that you are. Mm-hmm. You're constantly reaching out to other experts and sort of collating information. For me, here in New England, one of the things I learned in your book is how little we understand about jay migration.
Oh, my goodness, yes.
Because we see jays migrate all the time in huge numbers. Like, if you go to Quabbin at the right time of the year, there'll be massive movements of jays.
Yep.
You can see it on the Cape. And I always assumed, I always assumed that it was directly linked to the acorn failures, but it's not that simple, as it's typical
not
in nature.
All.
Yeah,
not
talk
at
to
all.
Talk to me about what you learned.
Oh, God.
Or did learn.
What did I learn? Not much. The migration chapter was just a miasma for me because, no matter what source you turn to, people eventually sort of throw up their hands and say, we don't know what jays are doing when they migrate.
Wow.
Because
the
weird thing is that you can have a bird who's banded and you know the bird. And one year it might migrate and the next year it might stay put, which is not typical behavior.
No.
The other thing about blue jays is that they, along with the evening grosbeak, are the two North American birds who are latitudinal migrants,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to longitudinal migrants. In other words, they go east-west.
Yeah, that's how, when we see them, they're going, like if you're at South Quabbin looking, they're going directly west.
Yeah, yeah, right. And we don't know why. I mean, what's better about west, you know? And so, yeah, there's just all this stuff that's going on with jays that we don't know. And you'll have to pardon me. I don't know if you can hear the shutter clicking, but I've got two baby prairie warblers messing around in my flower garden here.
Oh, nice.
And I'm sorry, I have to photograph them.
I totally get that, and that's totally cool. Yeah, yeah. Things are, all the young are out of their nest right now here, and they're sort of milling around, putting on the pounds.
Oh, it's wonderful. And
it's a good time.
About my hummingbird garden because it's brightly colored, and they're trying to see if there's any food in the feeders for them. And
yeah, but prairie warblers are cool. That was the first bird song I learned as a child.
Oh, what a cool bird song to learn.
Yeah, but it's easy to learn because it just goes up the chromatic scale, and it's like, what else sounds like that?
Nothing else. I tell people it's like filling up a tiny bottle.
That's exactly it.
Yep, yep.
Now, Jemima was also on TV. It was on PBS.
Yeah, yeah. She's
a star, man.
Top shelf bird. Yeah, that was, again, the magic of social media where, you know, I'm posting about this baby jay that I'm raising, and it happens to fall into the hands of Ann Prum, who is the creator of Coneflower Studios, a wonderful natural history film production company. And she was in need of a villain for her special on butterflies, which is called Sex, Lies, mm-hmm. and Butterflies, which was for PBS Nature. She needed a bird that would, for the camera, smash and eat caterpillars, just to kind of show how caterpillars fuel the natural world. And she emailed me to ask if I might loan Jemima for that. And I said, well, what's involved? And she said, oh, we'll probably put her in a box with a green screen and some natural branches. And I said, you know, I think you might be able to work with her in nature. She's hanging around like a dirty shirt, but she's not going in no box. So that was, you know, understood from the very start. And Anne was like, great. And so we actually wound up having
Wait a minute, Julie. Yeah. Now that you've said that, the pressure is on you.
Exactly. The pressure is on me to keep the bird around until the cameraman can get out here, which was going to be another 2.5 weeks or something.
Whoa.
And I said, oh, man, she's getting wilder by the day. She's flying down the driveway. She's ganging up with other jays. I can't guarantee you she's going to be around. So we scrambled the wonderful Emmy Award-winning cameraman, Mark Carroll, to come out here, cinematographer, to come out here and make this film of her. And it actually happened, but that's one of my favorite chapters in the book because it shows, like, what a complete nut I am.
Yeah, you lay it out there. Basically, you get really, really, really tense and nervous.
Yeah,
stage, like, what a stage mom.
And the worst stage mother you ever saw. And trying to control a wild jay. I'm sorry.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Yeah, yeah, you can't use mind control. You can't use anything on a jay. They're going to do exactly what they want, when they want.
One of the amazing things that I also learned from you is how to recognize individual jays.
Yeah.
And a lot of people would think, they're not that distinctive. But one of the great things you do is you photograph basically everything that comes into your yard, as we just heard, as with the prairie warbler.
Right, right, right. Exactly.
And so you have this incredible backlog of photographs of these birds. And using very subtle things, you can then recognize individuals.
Yeah, and the camera is absolutely key in that because no human being can remember all this combination of subtle characteristics on a bird, at least not initially. And, Mark, the amazing thing that happened while I was working on – I've been working on my book talk for this book for about 4 months, and it's going to flash by in 50 minutes. But I liken it to doing animation where, you know, it's yeah, it's this finished product that goes really smoothly and is rollicking and fun, but
so like a flip. It's like a flip book. It's just go.
The months of work that go into creating a cogent slide presentation are just, for me, they're just inestimable. And with Jemima, I was drinking from a fire hose because I had literally, you know, videos of everything she did. So
oh my God!
It was a good problem to have, but it's just been incredibly. You know, insufferably detailed work to just like So basically what I did was I went through every photo I took of Blue Jays from May 2017 until the present. And I learned so much in the making of this talk, because what would happen is, as I was going through my old 2017 photos, I was recognizing birds left and right that I thought I met in 2018 or 2019.
Oh, wow.
And so, yeah, right? How cool is that?
But
so,
this has also inspired me to start doing the same thing at my feeders. And then for other birds like cardinals, like which ones are coming to your feeders when? And you can start to journal that, and it sounds like an incredible project. And it would also, it's the kind of citizen science thing that's a really great project for people to do.
Yeah, and you know, jays are uniquely suited to it. You mentioned cardinals. I have a few cardinals that I can tell from the others, but they're so generic. But jays have all this bling on them.
They really do.
They have the neck band, and they have the facial eye makeup, and they have...
Well, that's another reason to do this, is because, as you point out in the book, just to really look at a jay is going to reveal to you how incredible they look.
They are. They are incredible. And I'm convinced that all those markings, what that's about is individual recognition for other jays. So when you see these subtle differences in how heavy the brow mark is, let's say, or the eye line, to a jay, that jumps right out at them, because what do birds do for a living? They notice stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
They notice the little green caterpillar that's the exact same shade as the leaf, right? Whereas we humans just kind of walk by all that stuff. Well, I taught myself to look at them as they see each other, and it's been the most exhilarating, wonderful thing. But my best companion in that has been my 70-300 lens. Because I just take close-up portraits of every jay you see, compile them, figure out what's different about each one, and
then name them according to the things that are different.
Name them according to the things that are different, so that it's an easily retrievable name that really kind of conjures.
We're completely out of time, Julie.
So why?
Because I didn't want to give away a lot of information in the book, because your writing counts. And is really the real reason to read this book. My guest tonight is Julie Zicafus, artist, writer, natural historian, and I'm talking about her new book, Saving Jemima, Life and Love with a Hard Luck Jay. It's a really great book to read. It's a beautiful book to look at, but it's an important book to read. Julie, it's a pleasure as always.
Thank you so much, Mark. This has been great.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.